there. This is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Sharna Ulfman. She's a professor of developmental and clinical psychology at Point Park University in Pittsburgh and a psychologist in private practice. She is editor of the Childhood in America book series and recently edited the new book, Drugging Our Children, How Profiteers Are Pushing Antipsychotics on Our Youngest and What We Can Do to Stop It. So welcome to Madness Radio, Sharna Ulfman.
I am so glad to be here.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming. It's a really, really important topic because as we're going to be getting into on the show, the use of dangerous antipsychotics is climbing among children, even kids as young as first and second graders and even into kindergarten and younger. Tell us about how you got alerted to the issue of child drugging. You're a mother yourself, is that right?
Yes, I am. I have two teenagers, but I think that I really started to get deeply interested in the issue when my oldest child, who's now 18, was ready to enter kindergarten. And I discovered that, you know, various kindergartens had entrance exams, and it seemed like such a strange thing to me that there was, you know, such a high level of academic expectation for children who were only 4 years old. I also started to sort of tune into the fact that academic pressures were really developmentally inappropriate. And that's when I really started to tune into the issue of the extent to which kids were being placed on psychiatric medications and some of the environmental and cultural factors that have led to the inappropriate drugging of children.
So that's really interesting. You're saying that there is both a pressure to succeed academically that reaches all the way down into kindergarten, and also you're saying that there's an unreasonable expectation for children to do things that don't fit with their developmental needs at that age, and that's when the medications come in. Don't the doctors say that, well, look, this child has ADHD, they have a disease, they have a disorder, they have a behavioral problem, that's why they need the medication, but you're challenging that view.
Yes, that is true. I think that most of the reasons that kids are medicated these days, the diagnostic categories that are used, that there's really not a lot of science behind them. You gave the example of ADHD. If you look at the criteria for ADHD, that a child is more impulsive than the average, that a child has more difficulty paying attention than the average. I do this all the time with my undergraduate students. I say, well, name 10 reasons as to why a child might be impulsive. Name 10 reasons as to why a child might have difficulty paying attention. These are such generic symptoms, and so it becomes difficult to really convincingly suggest that something like ADHD is a bona fide disease in the way that diabetes is a disease. And there really are no blood tests, there are no biochemical markers, there are no brain markers for what we call ADHD. And so I think that we as a culture have become convinced that when children are suffering, when they're showing emotional distress, when they are showing behavioral issues, that they probably have some type of genetically determined brain disorder, but there really isn't a lot of science to back that up. I also want to add that I feel as though we have taken children's emotions, we have transformed human emotion into symptomatology. So when a child is sad, we say that they're depressed. When a child is elated, we say that they're manic. When a child is in a rage, we say that they're manic. When a child is frightened, we say that they're anxious. And we have stopped, in a sense, listening to the powerful communications that children are offering us, and instead saying, oh, maybe she's bipolar, maybe she's depressed, maybe she's anxious, maybe she has poor impulsivity. And I think that that's very highly problematic. And when children's emotions are very, very intense, my own experience from my clinical work is that, generally speaking, there is a compelling reason for it, that maybe there is abuse, or maybe there is a child struggling to cope in an environment that is not a developmentally appropriate environment. So we really have kind of narrowed our understanding or our way of thinking about children's suffering, children's emotional suffering, and as a result, we're kind of drugging their emotions into silence, but we're not really looking at the root cause of their suffering.
Bring us up to date on this history, because that has kind of grown and changed, and now the big concern is the explosion of antipsychotic prescriptions. So
right. So in the 70s, pharmaceutical companies were pushing the stimulant medications, and that also, well, it was just sort of deemed to be a cost-effective way to deliver psychiatric care to kids. In the late 80s and 90s, partly probably because some of the stimulant medications were going off patent, and so the pharmaceutical industry needed to kind of create new primary diagnostic categories and push another set of drugs on kids, the SSRI antidepressants became the drug du jour for children.
Like Prozac and Paxil.
Right. The antidepressants became the drug du jour. But somewhere around the mid-1990s, when the new classes of antipsychotics were really, really being pushed, because the old classes of antipsychotics were going off patent and were no longer profitable.
So these are the drugs like Geodon and Risperdal and Abilify.
Correct. So these are sometimes called the atypical antipsychotics or the second generation antipsychotics. Now, these were drugs that were originally designed to treat adult schizophrenics, but that's a very small market. And so the drug companies were looking to expand that market. And along came one of the most powerful thought leaders in child psychiatry, a man named Joseph Biederman, who, as we discovered just a couple of years ago, was taking a considerable amount of money from various pharmaceutical companies. He started to push the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, that in fact, children who are frequently irritable, children who are overly aggressive, children who have really poor impulse control are in fact probably bipolar. And he really, the research on which he was basing these claims is very, very flimsy. But because of the way in which he reconceptualized and pushed the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, along with that was the claim that the best way to treat so-called pediatric bipolar disorder was through a combination of antipsychotic and anticonvulsant medication. And the anticonvulsant medication sort of was reframed as a mood stabilizer.
Because originally that medication was used for seizure disorders and epilepsy.
Correct. Correct. And suddenly this anti-seizure medication somehow got transformed into mood stabilizers.
And subsequently to him sort of leading this research charge to claim that there is pediatric bipolar in epidemic numbers, which was fueled by his taking money from the pharmaceutical companies, that's when the diagnosis of bipolar disorder just skyrocketed in the United States.
It did. There was an unbelievable, an unprecedented 40-fold increase in the number of children diagnosed with bipolar disorder between 1994 and 2003.
So it's a 4,000% increase. That's a dramatic marketing impact, really. It's promoting a brand. The brand of bipolar was spread by corporate funding through the culture. And then as a result, you have this market created, and all these adults and children are now on bipolar medication that they wouldn't have
been.
That
is correct. And the consequence of that is that in the 2000s, there has been, in the early, like, you know, say between 2001 and 2007, there was a doubling of the number of children on antipsychotic medication and a quadrupling of the number of kids who received Medicaid, who are now taking antipsychotic medication. And the numbers are even higher for kids who are cared for by the state, whether they are imprisoned or in psychiatric facilities or foster care. As many as 50% of children in foster care on any given day are taking antipsychotics. And it gets worse because a majority of kids who are on antipsychotics are on what is called a polypharmacy regimen, which means that they are on multiple meds. And so the way it usually works is a child is somewhat troublesome or troubling or struggling in some way. And so maybe the doctor starts with a stimulant and that doesn't do anything. And so they add to the stimulant an antidepressant and that doesn't do anything. And then they sort of move up to the antipsychotics and to perhaps a mood stable, they throw a mood stabilizer in, and that doesn't do anything. And so then they start to up the dosages, or they start to play with different combinations of these various classes of drugs.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and we're speaking with Professor Sharna Olfman. She's professor of developmental and clinical psychology at Point Park University in Pittsburgh, and a psychologist in private practice. She's the editor of the Childhood in America book series, and she recently edited the new book, Drugging Our Children, How Profiteers Are Pushing Antipsychotics on Our Youngest and What We Can Do to Stop It. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
And then it gets worse than that, because whereas in recent years there has been FDA approval for the use of antipsychotics to treat pediatric bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, and aggression in connection with autism, even though the, you know, the research is was funded by drug companies and the FDA, the research that led to FDA approval is questionable in and of itself. But what's even worse is that today, a majority of children who are prescribed antipsychotics have been prescribed them for what are called off-label uses of the medication. So kids today are being given antipsychotics for ADHD, for anger management, for impulsivity, for insomnia, for post-traumatic stress disorder, obsessive-compulsive symptoms, and eating disorders. And these are not FDA-approved symptoms or diagnostic categories for the use of antipsychotics. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's illegal to bill Medicaid for prescriptions of medications that are being used for indications that are not FDA approved. It's just really, really gotten quite out of control.
And so what are some of the implications in terms of the effects of these medications on the people who are taking them?
They're frightening medications, especially for children, some of whom are as young as 3 and 4 years of age, to be given medications for which there is no research support, that are so profoundly damaging to developing brains and bodies. And I would like to share some of the, you know, the effects of the antipsychotics, especially on children whose brains and bodies are still developing. And there are just so many. And one of the reasons is that the older class of antipsychotics targeted the dopamine system. They targeted the neurotransmitter dopamine, and they decreased the amount of dopamine available in the brain. But the new antipsychotics target multiple brain chemicals. And so we see with long-term use that there are motor problems such as akathisia, which is like an inner agitation that's associated with a very high rate of suicide, tardive dyskinesia, involuntary rhythmic movements, which can become permanent with long-term use.
Which is a sign of neurological damage. It's a sign
absolutely.
That there's actually brain damage happening to the person, that
absolutely.
They start to develop tardive dyskinesia.
That is correct. And just sort of staying on that note, long-term use of, you know, the older antipsychotics and the newer antipsychotics are associated with shrinkage of brain mm-hmm. tissue, that mm-hmm. there's just less brain volume the longer that an adult remains mm-hmm. on an antipsychotic. And so mm-hmm. we can only imagine what the impact on a child who may have been put in an antipsychotic, you know, at school age or younger, mm-hmm. And, you know, what that impact on brain development
and we should
might
really,
be.
And we should really remember that that's how the drugs were marketed. They were marketed as, hey, we've recognized that the older drugs have all these terrible side effects. Now there's this new class. We're actually going to call them the atypicals, the different
right.
class, because
right.
it doesn't have the side effects. They work better. It's not as
right.
harmful to people. And then actually that has just completely fallen apart. It was a marketing campaign.
Right.
In fact, I think the British Medical Journal, which is one of the gold standard academic journals, said, look, there's no evidence that the newer antipsychotic drugs are any better or any more effective or any less dangerous than the older
Correct.
Ones.
Correct. And we could make the case that they're more dangerous because they impact the brain in a much broader way, that they're less specific mm-hmm, and that mm-hmm. we may discover that they're certainly not safer. And they're probably more dangerous.
And what would you just say to someone who's listening who is saying, well, look, I take antipsychotic drugs. I'm on Abilify. Mm-hmm. This helped me. I'm
right.
now, it's the one right. drug I've discovered that works for me. And
right.
I've definitely have met many people. I work with many people. And my own view is that, you know, to really respect where people are at. And of course, yes, of course, many people rely on medications and feel
right.
that they're helpful to them. But it's a question of being informed about
Absolutely.
The risks and about the dangers
Absolutely.
And about how the drugs work and don't work, and especially
right.
being informed about the placebo effect, because so much of
right.
it is the relationship you have with your prescriber, the attitude that you have to your drug, the whole expectations and belief system around can be incredibly powerful in shaping how the drug affects and the placebo effect. So you're not
right.
you're not taking an anti-medication position. This is more about, let's be honest about what the medications
exactly.
do.
I appreciate that you have clarified. I'm not taking an anti-medication position. I would argue that for children, because there is zero research support in favor of antipsychotic use with children, and at the same time, there is significant research that demonstrates that there is so much harm done, that by the time the child is in a position to be able to make decisions for themselves, significant harm may have already mm-hmm. taken place.
Let's just get away from drugging
right.
children, because it's
right.
really clear that alternatives need to be provided for children, and they don't have the choice, and the research is not there, and there's overwhelming evidence of damage.
I also want to comment that, you know, I'm in an interesting position because I'm a psychologist, and so I don't have the mandate to prescribe, but I frequently assess children who have already been prescribed a medication, who are already taking medication, and I frequently have an opportunity to speak to their parents, and I say, well, what do you know about this drug? What did your child's pediatrician or psychiatrist tell you about
mm-hmm.
this drug?
Mm-hmm.
Are you aware of the side effects? Are you aware of the withdrawal effects? And more often than not, they have not been properly informed. And had they been, they may have made a different choice on behalf of their child.
And also informing them about what's known and not known about the diagnosis, because I think a lot of parents
right.
are concerned that, well, my daughter has schizophrenia, my son has ADHD, we don't want to leave this
right.
untreated. We are
exactly.
told that if it's untreated, it's going to get worse, and that it's a medical condition, it's a biological,
right.
chemical.
I do want to just sort of make a brief caveat. It's very dangerous to just sort of throw out the bottle of pills because your child will go through withdrawal. And so even though you may have made a decision to take your child off of the medication, it is of vital importance that the weaning process take place under medical supervision and in a very graduated way. Because sometimes what happens is that the child is withdrawn from the medication and suddenly their, you know, emotions are all over the place and they're more impulsive or they're having nightmares, and the parent says, wow, they really needed this
drug in the first place. The idea is that, well, the illness has come back rather than seeing it as a drug withdrawal effect.
Rather than seeing it as a withdrawal effect. So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there.
That's very important, and that's actually one of the things that motivated me and other people to develop the Harm Reduction Guide to Coming Off Psychiatric Drugs, which we've talked about quite a bit on Madness Radio, which is a free guide that people can download that has a lot of basic information for you and your prescriber to learn about this process of coming off meds.
Well, what are the solutions? And it's complicated because I would say that the reason that we're seeing a rise in children's emotional issues are really a combination of perhaps what's happening in family life, but also what's happening in the wider culture. So we need to look at our educational system and the focus that we've given to standardized testing. We need to look at the ways in which we fail, as we talked about earlier, the ways in which we fail to support families. We need to provide maternity leave. We need to provide child sick leave. We need to increase the minimum wage so that parents don't need to work two shifts. But, you know, we can't wait for that to happen. We can't say, okay, well, let's just kind of throw in the towel, because until all of these big issues, you know, we change our system of education and we change public policies, we can't do anything. Parents still can make individual choices. So in terms of addressing some of the issues before they start, I would say, you know, when your child is an infant and a toddler and a preschooler, that's where you have most control over your child's environment. So maybe you want to turn off the TV and you want to turn off the computer screen. A child's brain will be most stimulated through human touch, through human conversation, through interaction and play in natural settings, through developing curiosity and imagination. Especially turn the TV off during dinner time. Just create an environment where your child knows that they're loved and where, you know, family time is valued. Don't imagine that 1,000 extracurricular activities for young children are the way to go. I think that children need time to play. They need time in nature. They need calm time with their families. They need time just to, you know, to read and reflect. And now when a child is troubled and they are showing behaviors that are frightening, they're cutting themselves, they're bullying, they are profoundly sad.
They have explosive meltdowns, or they get really disruptive in the class.
I think the first thing we need to do is we need to consider the possibility that they are trying to communicate something important to us, that this is not just a misfiring brain, but that maybe that we can understand what it is that they are trying to say and what it is that they're experiencing. Having said that, we also need to kind of consider the possibility that maybe they're having an allergic reaction. We need to look at those kinds of issues as well.
And this is where the role of family therapy and counseling can be really important. And what are just some examples of the kinds of things that a kid might be communicating with their emotional problems, their behavioral disruption? I mean,
the classic example is that the parents are fighting, and it's so painful for the child to observe the parents fighting. And so the child almost tries to distract them or to let the parents know that they need them, that they couldn't bear to lose one of them. And so the child starts to act in ways that are disruptive. And then suddenly the parents are training their attention on the child. And the parents aren't fighting anymore because they're sort of working together to try and help their child. And So that's just one of many, many examples of how sometimes children act out when there are problems or issues that are, you know, part of a family dynamic, that really the problem doesn't live in the child but lives in the family system. But family therapy has been around for many, many decades. There are all kinds of systems of individual psychotherapy and play therapy that where there is a tremendous amount of research support. These are not just approaches that just been thrown together or are experimental. And so that's the irony. These are systems of treatment where the research does exist and where the research is solid.
Sharna, we don't have a lot of time left. I just wanted to ask you, what do you think would be needed in the culture, the society, medical policy, government policy, to kind of make a shift away from the current move into drugs for children who have behavioral, psychological, emotional problems, and move more towards effective ways of helping kids and helping families that don't have the kind of harm associated with medication? What's really needed in larger policy, medical policy, yeah, and government policy?
The first thing that we need is we need to remove the conflict of interest between, drug company money and drug research. And so we need our government to fund research so that it is not muddied by the profit motive. And I think that we need to have more sanctions for psychiatrists who do not inform their patients about side effects. And we need to be more aware that psychiatrists do not have the legal right to prescribe drugs off-label and bill Medicaid, that this is an illegal practice. So we need to kind of enforce the laws that already exist, and we need to separate out research from drug company money.
And remind us the name of your latest book, and also if people want to contact you and find out more information about your work, how do they do that?
The title of the latest book is Drugging Our Children, How Profiteers Are Pushing Antipsychotics on Our Youngest and What We Can Do to Stop It. And if you want to get in touch with me, one way is to email me. And my email address is solfman, S-O-L-F-M-A-N, at pointpark.edu.
Sharna Olfman, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Sharna Olfman. She's a professor of developmental and clinical psychology at Point Park University in Pittsburgh and a psychologist in private practice. She's the editor of the Childhood in America book series, and she recently edited the new book, Drugging Our Children, How Profiteers Are Pushing Antipsychotics on Our Youngest and What We Can Do to Stop It. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall, music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio, to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.
And you do have it tuned to KBOO in Portland. We are having noon headlines coming up, followed by the Noontime Jamboree. So don't go anywhere.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Monday, March 2nd, 2015. Yesterday, police shot and killed a man in the Skid Row area of Los Angeles' downtown. The man's name has not been released to the public. He is known by his street name, Africa, which he is believed to have received because he is an African immigrant. The incident began when police pulled Africa out of his tent, where he was allegedly fighting. After bringing Africa to the ground, police report that he reached for one of their weapons, at which point they shot him. The incident gained attention when a video of it was posted on the internet. Within 7 hours of posting, it gained 6 million views. The incident has been captured on at least one police officer's body camera, but this footage has not been made public. Last Thursday, Portland City Council held a hearing on a number of development amendments. The council voted to close the Willamette Industrial Urban Renewal Area, located on both sides of the river in north and northwest Portland. It also voted to direct more development funds to the area around the new Orange Light Rail line going from Portland to Milwaukee in the central east side. City Council also voted to add pieces of the North McAdam development area to the Education District downtown. The education district is set to end, which Portland Development Commission said would generate $47 million in affordable housing. All told, the changes from Thursday's meeting could save the city more than $8 million. Last week's snowpack at Crater Lake set a record low. The official depth on Thursday was 28 inches, surpassing the previous record low for this time of year, 31 inches, set in 1977. Average snow depth for February 26th, based on previous records, is 110 inches. The low levels come in part from this year's unseasonably warm winter, which has melted snow. Crater Lake's light snowfall is part of an ongoing trend in the West, where many areas are reporting less than 10% of their usual snowfall. This is expected to exacerbate the ongoing drought in the West this spring. City officials in McMinnville have ordered a local church to shut down its homeless camp. According to the city manager,